How many times do you put your life on the line? Every time you log into a website, make an online purchase, or flash that pass card to enter the office, some part of your identity is going somewhere to be recorded and processed. We like to think the place it's going and the way it's being treated is legitimate and is owned solely by the people who are supposed to have it. We have dozens or even hundreds of identifications, and they are all essentially under the control of others. Is this, along with its risks and breaches, how it will always be, or is it time to reclaim sovereignty and truly own our own digital selves? This is the Talos Security Sessions podcast. I'm Steve Prentice. What we are talking about here is a concept called self-sovereign identities, SSI for short, and to explain what it is and what its possible role in our future can be, I have Paul Fisher, lead analyst at Coppinger Cole, a firm that specializes in the strategic management of digital identities, and Ward Duchamp, director of strategy and innovation at Talos. Ward, welcome to the Talos Security Sessions podcast.
Yeah, my pleasure being here. Thank you.
And Paul, same thing. It's a pleasure to see you as well.
Great. Yeah, thank you so much, Steve.
So, you know, what we're doing here today is just simply talking about this concept called self-sovereign identities. Now, this, again, is a term that may have different meanings for different people. So I'm just wondering if we can start with either of you, just wanting to clarify what is actually meant by a self-sovereign identity and why is this important now?
Self-sovereign is... the emphasis is on the self. The idea is, and it's still kind of a long way off, I think, in many ways, is that the identity owner has control over their identity and how they get access to things. And it's decentralized because it means that you could use that identity, I believe, for not just perhaps one piece of information or one workplace or one account, but for many. That's my explanation. I wonder if Ward has a different one.
Maybe. I would start off with an example, basically. It is really the analogy with a physical wallet. If you've got a physical wallet in your pocket, basically if you buy a new wallet, it's empty. And during your life cycle, you start collecting cards that you put into that wallet, like, for instance, a loyalty card or a driver's license or what have you. You start collecting different cards in that physical wallet. And just like with the physical wallet, you actually own the wallet and you have access to all these attributes in that wallet. And you can choose as the owner of that wallet on who that you want to show which card. And that concept in a digital world is actually self-sovereign identity. And so it brings us back to the very fundamental question on what an identity is. And if you look at some research from the psychoanalytics world, an identity is actually mostly about attributes that are assigned to an individual that have a certain value in a society, right? And so what we try to do now in the digital world is actually apply that same schema, so where it's not necessarily about the identifier of a user, but more about attributes of a person in a particular society.
So you would agree, Ward, that it gives the control to the person?
Totally. Just like in the physical world, I can choose to show my loyalty card, yes or no. Also in the digital world, now we have the ability to give the end user control over what he can share with whom. I think that in the line of business that we are in the identity industry, I think that in the past few years, we were way too focused on identifiers rather than on attributes. So because IT people think about an object linked to an identifier, that we thought about, we have to find an identifier for each and every identity. While this paradigm now is a little bit changing with self-sovereign identity, because it's no longer about a unique identifier for one particular individual, but it's more about a set of attributes that determine what you can do or what claim that you make about a person.
Okay, so we're looking then at this notion of self-sovereign identities as maybe a new solution, a better solution. But why now? It sounds good, but what is wrong with what we currently have? Where are the weaknesses? What's the problem that we're looking to solve?
I think now we get into the, you know, probably the nitty gritty of the conversation, because it's more about what our identities are, how we manage them, who controls them in a much wider way. So, you know, we give our permission to, say, a social network or a bank. We give permission for them to give us permission to get access, and they dictate how we get that. So if we have a self-sovereign identity, like the wallet that Ward was talking about, it belongs to us, and we can decide what attributes, what information, what identifies us as a digital identity. We control that, and we can decide who gets to use that. So it's giving the sort of agency back to the individual, which we've lost somewhat in the great internet rush with, you know, the desire to be online with everything and everybody. I don't know where the impetus has come from. I think it's partly kind of privacy groups and other bodies that are saying it's about time that we stopped allowing giant corporations to harvest our data. And I think for a while, the public kind of were quite, not ignorant, I don't think ignorant is a nice thing to say, but I don't think they were aware of just how much their data was being abused and how their identities were being used to access all sorts of things, you know, cookies, etc. online. So it's a combination of better awareness amongst individuals and also the industry. Some parts of the industry, like Apple, I think, I wouldn't give any giant tech group gold stars for privacy or data usage, but Apple at least has led the way, for example, saying stop apps tracking your usage across other apps and things like that. And I think that has set a trend, and I think it's catching on.
So there's a couple of things we can take from this. The first of all is that the idea that people now have greater control over their identity sounds like a great idea. Do you, Ward, have great faith in the average person's capacity to maintain that security, given that we've just all got a terrible track record of not changing passwords and being incredibly carefree about our security and our data to this point? What is to say that this new concepts would not go down the same path, given that the human being unfortunately always ends up being the weakest link in a security chain?
That is a fair concern, and digital inclusion is an important topic where we have to deal with as tech providers, because we know that not every individual will be as keen as we want to be with new technology. And we now introduce new concepts which are sometimes very hard to understand, even within our industry. And so actually it boils down to your question also on the why now. I see a lot of push from government, especially in Europe. I'm based in Europe, so the GDPR and the EIDAS and initiatives like that are actually driven by regulators rather than by industry. So I actually hope that regulators and government actually will play an important role there to make sure that there's a sufficient education to the people on how to deal with these new types of technology. Because we indeed assume now that end users take an important role in protecting their data. If they do not do so, then the model fails again.
So we have a kind of a cautious optimism that human beings in general will be able to adapt to this and see its usage, right? There is a sort of a willful denial that happens with a lot of people with regards to data. And there's also the argument that people will say, well, some of the more enlightened of any group will say, well, I trade my data for access, right? I mean, when Facebook or Meta or anybody else uses the data, some of us realize we are not the customer, but the product. And we're trading our data for their usage of cloud or whatever else they're providing. So if we've got this idea then, which is as old as humanity in a way of wanting to keep control over our identities and individualities, this is a new technology, a new technique, but clearly it's still got to be run from somewhere in order to be validated and to be safe. Now, is this an ideal candidate for blockchain as sort of the place, the beachhead for decentralized identities? I've read about the FIDO Alliance. Is this where we can take this, or is blockchain a complicating factor?
Like Ward was saying, there is a risk that a sovereign identity comprising of many different attributes could be stolen. You could literally somehow grab that full package of attributes and use it to impersonate the real identity owner. But you kind of hit the nail on the head, Steve, when you mentioned blockchain, and no one's cracked it yet. But the way to do self-sovereign would be that, for example, each person would create an identity of themselves, which would then be held in some kind of secure, very advanced quantum cryptographic vault, which could be commercially owned or it could be government owned. I mean, again, can you trust governments any more than you can trust corporations? But the idea would be that that identity would be linked to you or some kind of biometric, perhaps a face and your eye scan. And when you log on to something, this something looks into this blockchain or this vault of identities and matches you with the face scan and to that identity that's held there. The key thing is that you as a user choose the attributes that are held within that vault. The management of the vault or the administrators of the vault, whether they be a government or an organization, have no access to the data or the information that's held in there. They simply can match the biometric to that data. So that's, it's easy to say that, though. To actually create something like that would take some geniuses to make it completely uncrackable. But the one thing that we do have in common, or rather we don't have in common with each other, is that our biometrics, even twins, so-called identical twins, are never actually completely identical. So some kind of advanced biometrics, every single leaf in the world is different. So you could call, you know, everybody would have a leaf which is their own facsimile of their identity. So that's the theory. Whoever cracks it will either be liked a lot or make a lot of money. But it, again, what tends to happen is, as we've seen with ChatGPT, that it's always the corporations that get there first.
Corporations or cyber criminals, of course, who see the advantage. I mean, my first thought right there from a mercenary standpoint is to open up a business offering a consulting service to people to help set up their identity, which, of course, would make me the filter to own all this before it goes in. However, it's a great idea, great concept. There is, of course, once again, the issue, perhaps a potential pushback. When we start to talk about biometrics, a certain proportion of the population gets a little bit nervous, similar as with vaccines. Mandates and so forth. Even tracking people through biometrics and facial recognition is not a popular topic. And as a sort of a primary vehicle of integrating this, it may experience some challenges. So, Award, do you have any concerns about the theoretical benefits and potential of doing this versus, once again, the traditional, not the willful ignorance we mentioned before, but now the overt opposition to the use of biometric data as the key to my identity?
Actually, there I see the tech giants play an enormous role in the adoption of biometrics. If you look at the FIDO Alliance, that basically the alliance is one of the most impactful standardization initiatives in the last decades, right? Because we see a lot of competitors actually join forces to build a critical mass to adopt a new way of working. And so FIDO brings cryptographic mechanisms to the device of the end user. And then the tech giants actually translate that into an acceptable user experience by adopting biometrics to unlock these cryptographic mechanisms on the device. And so if Apple says and if Google basically promotes the use of biometrics, I think I would give it a fair chance to increase adoption globally. That being said, I also am a very firm believer that we always need a fallback mechanism. And so there we have to fall back on mechanisms like identity verification based on maybe documents that need to be scanned, but also backtracking the behavior of an end user and using behavior as a non-intrusive biometric pattern that can be used to kind of identify the user. So it's not only about facial and fingerprint. There are so many different biometric elements, metrics that we can actually use. And it's the combination of that that gives us a certain level of assurance. So it's no longer a binary exercise, is this user now authenticated or not, but it's more like a grayscale between 0 and 10, how much can we trust this digital interaction?
Yeah, biometrics have been used for decades in passports. The photograph for a long time was the only way of establishing whether the person holding the passport was the rightful owner. But we all know from every spy movie ever made that that's very, very easily overcome. The other thing is that I think people quite, like you mentioned Apple, I mean, I'm quite happy using my face to log into my phone. There's a bit of a leap, though, to say to people, all you need to do is show your face to any old camera to log into your bank account. And I think people think, I don't feel quite right about that, even though it's all happening in the background. They still psychologically think, oh, there has to be an extra step. There has to be a password. There has to be a secret number to make me feel more secure. So having this self-sovereign identity solves the idea of giving back control. But would people trust it? Ward, you were shaking your head there, I noticed. But
so what FIDO introduces is they introduce boundaries on the use of biometrics, biometric controls. And the boundary is that you actually use biometric controls between the individual user and the mobile device or the personal device. And that's actually a good paradigm because that assures that biometric data is actually not shared in a central database or something like that. But it's only between the user and the device. The trusted link between these two that actually gives you a level of assurance to use a digital service. And so it definitely not promote to just only use facial recognition to open a bank account in a bricks and mortar bank office. But facial recognition might be good enough to open your bank app on your mobile device because you enrolled your mobile device. So the biometric control is a way to unlock your device rather than just one of the mechanisms.
Yeah.
So again, in theory, this sounds fantastic. It, again, may have a bit of a tough sell, as you said, for a large amount of people who believe you have to have a password or something that they're used to as that key, almost literally, to get in. So can we talk a moment about the trust triangle? Is that something that we can bring in here? Because this seems to be central to like an ecosystem of verifiable credentials, where you've got a trust triangle between the issuer, the holder, and a verifier. Now, this reminds me of that idea that a secret is no longer a secret as long as more than one person knows it. So does this concept of the trust triangle make sense to you as a way of keeping things safe between three bodies in this relationship?
Well, recent events have proven that the third party is actually sometimes the weakest link. If we look at the attack on the casino in Las Vegas, it was the third party identifying app that was basically breached, not MGM itself. So once they'd got through that, they could bypass everything and they were in. So you and the bank, I trust my bank, and the bank in theory should trust me. So we have a good one-to-one relationship in that sense. So that centuries of banking have meant that the one thing they value more than anything else is not just their assets, but trust. Because if you have no trust in a bank, everything breaks down. You know, then you get a run on the bank, etc. Or if you, as happened in the UK, when a well-known politician's account details were leaked to the newspapers, then the bank CEO was fired. So the trust triangle isn't perfect in any way. It's an assistance. And that comes back to the idea of the self-sovereign identity using some kind of thing that houses all the identities. If that was actually hacked, then the whole thing would break down. So
it's about maturity of the standards. So today, I think that the standards are at a certain level of maturity where we can deal with the triangle of trust in a linear process, where there is indeed a defined level of trust between issuer, holder, and verifier. Like, for instance, with mobile driver's license, there's clearly one line that is adopted. But once that you start sharing the same verifiable credential with multiple verifying parties, there is still a challenge on how to do the plumbing to make sure that the verifier gets everything that he needs to verify a credential. And so blockchain might be one of the mechanisms to help resolve that, but some people say that that's not the only solution either. And currently the verification depends on basically a directory of keys, which is different than what we did in PKIs in the past. Why did we do so in the standard? Is there a compelling reason? Some people refer to it as we still lack some kind of plumbing between issuer and verifier at a global scale, just like what we did in the financial industry. So my point is that the triangle works or should work well if all parties are very well defined, and if there is indeed a trust level that can easily be established. But it's not yet built for scale. And there we still have work to be done.
And also, every check and balance in the MGM case was completely undermined by the fact that all that the attackers did was search LinkedIn for people that made it obvious that they were senior administrators at MGM. And they simply, the full details of this has never really come out for obvious reasons, but it seems to be that they simply rang a help desk and said, oh, I've lost my credential, I've lost my password. And no second factor was asked at that point, which is quite extraordinary.
It's the digital security Maginot line.
Yeah.
Things like LinkedIn.
Go around it.
Yeah, you just go around it. Mm-hmm. I only have two things left to ask of you because your time is valuable and I really appreciate it. So to start with, Ward, who would you see as the most qualified to take the reins? Is this a government thing, a per-country government thing? Should this be one of these collaboratives that we are seeing in security around the world? Who really should take the reins of SSI for us as global citizens?
So I've got high hopes from alliances like FIDO that actually could be instrumental in driving the adoption of this. And that linked to the power of a government. So what we now see with eIDAS is a push towards more interoperability between different member states in Europe. And so it's the government that actually is driving a technology evolution rather than the technology providers. And I think that's a good thing. And if we can combine that government push with an open standards-based mindset, then we can actually first design a solution before that the technology actually starts building solutions for it. And so I'm actually a big fan of how the EI process looks like so far. There are some questions about how much government can now see and cannot see, and how can a citizen in one member state be linked to activities in another member state and stuff like that. So there are still issues to be resolved, right? But overall, the idea of building an interoperable identity schema for a region in the world, I like that idea. And I think that there we can really get the drives from.
And Paul, your thoughts about ownership?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's really tough, because I don't think I'd trust either of those bodies on their own to do this. I mean, I might trust my government, the UK government or the German government or maybe some other Western governments to do something. But if it was an individual government, then they would probably just do it for government business. But it also, the problem there is, if you don't involve big tech, it's likely that it'll never get off the ground because, you know, the governments just don't have the resources or usually the brains to do this sort of thing. So that leaves a partnership for tech companies. So we'd have to trust some company, an independent group that tech companies support that could do this. Neither of those is ideal, but how else are we going to do it? And things like FIDO, and there are, you know, good stuff happening, industry alliances happening that are improving identity. So I would say yes, but be very careful that we don't make the mistakes of the first 20 years of the internet by giving unfettered access to people's data and allow companies like Meta and Google to grow fat on basically our data. Your second question is whether it's any actually a good thing. Yes, it's got to be a good thing. The theory, SSI, it's got to be a good thing, giving people their own control over an identity. So yeah, I'm optimistic. And I think just as we enter the age of, generative AI and everything else, we seem to be going through revolutions. First, we had the web, which changed everything. Then we had the iPhone, which changed the usage of the web completely and then ushered in the age of the social media giants. And now we've got AI, probably going to have as much change placed upon us. So maybe the answer will come out of some kind of AI, but you can't uninvent these things. We have to work with them. But I do think let's not create another Meta or another Google or another tech giant that we all have to use because there's no alternative. There should be alternatives and they should be run differently and they should be done for our benefit and not profit, or at least not for ridiculous amounts of profit.
So same question, Ward, to yourself. We have had a discussion here that has gone back and forth about the positives and negatives, which is a good analysis of any new technology. So what are your feelings? Is SSI a good thing for us as individual people and as for businesses? What's your thought looking forward?
I think it's definitely a very good technology evolution, right? Because we break the paradigm of the central database. What we've been doing in the past two decades is building central databases where we store personal information. And now we've got technology to break that paradigm and bring that personal information back into the hands of an individual. So all for it, this is a good evolution. Are we at the final step yet? No, I don't think so. But at least we make a huge step forward. And so I see this as a technology brick that we can use for identities. But an identity does not necessarily mean a physical person. It could also become a device. And with the myriad number of IoT or connected devices that we now have, including all the AI bots that we have to deal with, we also have to find a solid foundation to also identify these non-human identities as well. And I think that the wallet also could actually solve partly that problem, or has the potential to also solve that partly that problem as well. So I'm positive.
Yeah, there is a tendency for tech giants or the men that run them to want to control everything. They want, like, even Bill Gates wanted to create an alternative to the internet. Steve Jobs wanted Apple to dominate, etc. And I think Tim Berners-Lee, the inventor of the World Wide Web, he could have been one of those billionaires right now if he'd taken a different path. But he gave it to humanity. And unfortunately, we probably haven't used it as best as we could. But as we move into this next era, things will improve.
So lots of great food for thought. It's like describing or explaining what blockchain is to people who've never seen it. Some people think it may be a solution looking for a problem. But I think the problem has emerged. We have to maintain and protect our identities even more so now. It's not just simply human thieves and human bad actors, but so many other technologies. So as opposed to being exactly that, a solution without a problem, I think it's a matter of just bringing the problem to light and recognizing this as a great potential. So Ward, thank you so much for joining us here on the Talos Security Session podcast.
It was my pleasure being here. Thank you.
And Paul Fisher, also, it's been a pleasure talking to you as well. So thank you for being here as well.
Thank you, Steve. Been a pleasure as well.
My thanks once again to Paul Fisher, lead analyst at Coppinger Cole, and Ward Dujon, director of strategy and innovation at Talos. Remember, if you like what you hear, be sure to subscribe and tell a friend or a colleague or a client or all of them about the Talos Security Sessions podcast. We will be back again next month with another episode and another discussion on the topics that you need to know about to successfully carry on in the business of information security. Until then, I'm Steve Prentice. Thanks for listening.